Hello and welcome to FYI today. We are happy to be here. We are plant-based OKC. We're always with you on this fourth Tuesday of the month. And I am Andrea Conway, and I'm here with my husband, who's a board-certified orthopedic surgeon, Dr. Jimmy Conway.
Hello, everyone. And board-certified in lifestyle medicine.
Yes, I was going to get to that, but we also have our good friend Randy Titone,
the plant-based evangelist.
I'm board certified in friendliness.
That's
boy,
a good
that
thing.
Is really true, Randy.
Yeah. So speaking of that, we do want to congratulate you on your new board certification in lifestyle medicine. Yay!
Hardest test I have ever taken.
I know, and here you've been board certified in orthopedic surgery for 20-some years.
Since 1991.
And this was the hardest test you've taken.
Correct.
Well, I thought maybe you might give people a little... Well, first let me... If you're new listening
why
to us...
Here?
Why are we here? And who are we?
That's right.
So, like I said, we are plant-based OKC, and that is really just a name we've given ourselves. It's not any kind of... for-profit organization. We're not a company. We're not a nonprofit organization. We just are who we are, just the three of us who go around discussing what we feel to be the healthiest way to eat, which is a whole food plant-based diet or whole food plant-based lifestyle. Now that we're in 2019, this is going to be our 10th anniversary of eating this way, which I can't even, when we started, I remember, my gosh, we've eaten this way for 30 days, and we've eaten this way for 6 months, and now here we are talking about it 10 years later. It's really, really hard to believe, but could not be more thankful and happy that we had a life-changing, transformative moment to bring us to where we are today, because I fully believe my husband would not be here with us today had we not made those changes when he was told nearly 10 years ago now that he needed a triple bypass, and we opted to forego the surgery and change our lifestyle, and here we are today. So what we do is go around talking about that. We tell our story about how we came into a whole food plant-based lifestyle, what it's done for us, and Randy gives his testimony as how he got to us through that as well, and
through music.
Yes.
That's right.
Yep. And so now...
We need to thank Train.
That's exactly right.
You send them a note. So now we go around talking about this, and we do it all for free because we feel like it is such an important message. And what we're going to talk about today is how the different messages get skewed. And so that's why we do what we do, and we do it for free. And we hold monthly forums. We try to do it every month, and we have what we call a Nutrition 101 seminar. These are held at Community Hospital, which is a small hospital in South Oklahoma City, not the big
not
South
to be confused
community.
With the old South community.
Yes, this is at Southwest 89th and May. They graciously let us use their cafeteria on a Saturday when it's closed, and so we're able to go in there and hold these seminars, which we typically have about 40 to 50 people a month coming to these seminars. We started it by being just some of my husband's patients because he was talking about nutrition to them in his office, and it was taking so long. He just doesn't, as many of you probably know, and you know, an office visit with a doctor is usually about 15, 20 minutes, and you don't have time to talk about nutrition and everything else that you have going on. And
yeah, so in an orthopedic office, it's usually about 5 minutes.
Okay, well, that's really not enough
it, not
time.
It
is
not
really
me.
Not enough time to talk about nutrition.
That and is true.
So we developed a presentation that we started doing free once a month, and it just started out with maybe 20 people of his patients, and then they would come and they would want to bring their friends and other family members. And so it just kept growing and growing. And so here we are today. We've been doing these seminars now for, when did you, were we doing them when you
just started?
Okay.
So a little over 6 years ago.
Wow.
Yeah.
So 6 years we've been doing these seminars. And
you mentioned the word free a couple of times, and I think we probably ought to expound on that. I mean, because you and I had the discussion early on about whether to charge for the seminars, and we both kind of came to the conclusion that if we do it for free, then what do we have to gain doing it? I mean, it's not a financial thing.
Yeah, and we kind of poke fun when people come to the seminars about, you know, they're there for some kind of a Tupperware party or, you right. know, just because everybody thinks there is some, at the end of the meeting, there's going to be some kind of catch. We're going to be selling something, or we're going to want them to sign up for something. And it's funny how when they find out truly at the end of the seminar, and we're like, okay, that's all the information. That's it. And they're like,
they still
what?
Think.
There's got to be more. There's right. got to be some, you know, catch to this. And there really is not. We give of our time. Like I said, there's, you know, upwards of 40 to 50 people. I cook a meal for them and serve a plant-based lunch, so hopefully they can get an idea of what a tasty, no meat, no dairy,
no added oil
meal can be, how tasty it can be. And so we serve that, and we provide a notebook for everyone to leave with this information that we're talking about, so they can review it at later dates for other information. And yeah, we made a conscious effort to do that for free, so that people would realize that we mean what we say. We stand behind what we say. We do this because we truly, truly believe the power of medicine can prevent and reverse the chronic diseases that we are faced with
the
today.
Power of food, not medicine.
Oh, did
unless
I say medicine?
Yes,
oh,
you
gosh.
Said medicine.
No, that would be kind of an oxymoron.
It is, really.
It is the power of food can be medicine.
That's
and
true.
Change your life.
There was a guy that was born in 460 BC that kind of said that. His name was Hippocrates.
Let food
be
thy
medicine,
and medicine thy food. And that's kind of been our credo for our little group organization that we've started. And so if you're interested in these monthly seminars that we talked about, we have a website, plantbasedokc.com, and under that website you'll see a tab for wellness events. So anytime we're going to be anywhere speaking or have one of these nutrition seminars, that's listed under wellness events. And there'll be a link to, you'll see the information on there. Then there'll be a link to email for a reservation if you're interested in attending. Our next seminar, since we did not have one in December, we're kind of backlogged. And so this next one in January is actually full at this point. So we will be setting a February date soon. So please check the website for that date and sign up if you're interested. The other thing we do is the first Monday of every month, we host a meeting at Rococo Restaurant in North Park Mall.
Except this month. It's the second Monday.
Oh, it is. The first Monday was
New Year's.
Yeah. So in January, we did have to change. But these meetings came about because we had started the Nutrition 101 seminars, and we were getting lots of questions from people that had attended about once they left the meeting and got started, they still had some questions, or, you know, you just get started down this path and, you know, you kind of feel like the lone wolf out there sometimes. You know, you go to work and you're the only one that's doing this, and people start telling you you're going to die. You're going to die of lack of protein and all these things. And so you start to question yourself, are you doing the right thing? So we decided a support group meeting would be good. So these meetings held at Rococo are really just that. They're informal. They're to meet other people who are like-minded, that are wanting to get healthy, that are maybe they're just now starting their journey, or maybe they've been eating this way for several years. And so it's good to connect with other people, and we're there to answer questions and help where we can. And I give out recipes and all kinds of stuff like that. So again, the website, plantbasedokc.com, under wellness events, will have the date and the time listed for those meetings as well. Then we also give of our time coming here to KTLV and doing our radio show monthly, and we enjoy coming to do this. We didn't really think that we had much of an audience, and then we found that
It's worldwide.
Apparently we do.
That's exactly right.
And we've had some people come from other states to our seminars because they heard us on the radio and wanted to meet us. And so we were very pleased to know that that we actually have somebody listening.
Absolutely.
So we try to pick a topic when we come on here to discuss, and it's various. And I apologize if sometimes we repeat ourselves. We could probably be more organized and write down what we talk about every month and then have an agenda, but we don't.
It wouldn't go very well.
There's no need for that.
We don't do that. We just, it is what it is. And
that's right.
We like to talk off the cuff because we never know where that might take us. But so today we got an idea because in recent paper, we read the newspaper. We still actually read the newspaper, Randy.
Only people over 50 do.
Hey, I just turned 50 not that long ago, and I've been reading the paper for a while now.
Well, you were ahead of your time.
You're an outlier.
So in the Sunday paper, there was these headlines always get me. It's low carb, ? Low fat, ? What the latest dieting studies tell us.
Which is nothing.
And right. This was just a typical article that's published, or same thing can be, you know, if you watch the news or any kind of the talk shows or whatever, any of this kind of stuff is brought up on there. And one day you'll hear something and you'll think, oh, well, that makes sense. And then literally the next day, the same show will have alternate information that makes what they said the day before not make any sense. And I really believe that it's just to keep us all to keep the public confused.
Absolutely.
About what might be healthy and what's not healthy and how to eat and not eat. And I just think about the way I was raised and my grandparents, and we didn't talk about stuff like, we didn't think twice about really what was healthy or not healthy. I mean, the way I grew up was you just ate a moderate amount of food. We didn't have pop and cookies and cakes and all this processed stuff in our house. We just ate real food, and you ate moderate amount. You know, I look back, I have some of my grandmother's dishes, and the plates are even...
Right.
They're so much smaller. It's like their dinner plate is almost the size of our side plate, literally.
Correct.
And so when you look at that, and like just our servings of everything are just monumental. I mean, and that's what people look for if they go to a restaurant. How much do you get?
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's like all you can eat this or all you can eat that. And the servings are just enough for two or three people. And so I think, you know, so much has changed, and so therefore we've gotten heavier over all these decades. And so now, you know, everybody wants these minute details about what is it that I really should be eating. And they, you know, we talk about getting caught up in the nutrients, like we laugh about protein. Are you going to get enough protein? But, you know, when we tell people how we eat, that's exactly what we get asked. Well, how are you going to get enough protein?
And that's
how did you ever know you were getting enough? Just for the simple fact that you were eating a piece of chicken or a hamburger, in their mind, that was going to be enough protein to suffice.
Well, in extrapolating on some of this, so last week, the famous TV doctor Oz had people on there talking about all of these different ways to eat bacon, preparing bacon, and you know, it was candy wrapped and chocolate wrapped, and just, you know, how you should really cook it. It shouldn't be in a skillet. It should be in the oven and all this. And I'm thinking, you know, this guy's like the Pied Piper, you know? I mean, he's just going to lead people off the edge of a cliff because people follow what he says so.
And his information changes
every day.
But it changes because he has had Dr. Esselstyn and Dr. Campbell on his show.
And Dr. Furman.
And talked about, and Garth Davis and all kinds of people. And he'll say to them when they're on there, oh, I believe this is the healthiest way to eat. And I'm behind all, you know, and they
and
talk about
talk
it.
About, have somebody in there talking about butter.
Butter or bacon.
And so how, if you listen to that show every single day, it's no wonder you would be at a complete loss.
And it's no wonder he was called before Congress because of his inaccurate...
Coffee bean extract and green tea.
Inaccurate answers. And, you know, all the doctor shows, the show called The Doctors, at least 95% of their information is wrong. I mean, that's been shown with research because it's whatever makes a headline. It's like this headline in the paper, low carb, low fat, what the latest dieting studies tell us. Well, these studies actually tell us nothing because there was a study published.
I was going to say, kind of go over what that says and why it's inaccurate.
Well, part of it, they're quoting the study. So I actually found the study and read it. And it is ridiculous, one, that it was published because their low-fat dieting arm, 29% of their calories came from fat. That's not considered low-fat around the world. I mean, low-fat is 10 to 15% of your calories are coming from fat. And so it's no wonder that this study didn't show any difference between low fat versus low carb. It's because it really wasn't low fat. It was not even moderately low fat. I mean, 29% of your calories, that is low when you look at a standard American diet.
Which but is probably 50 or 60%
right,
fat.
But it's not low fat. And it's the same argument that came up at least 15 years ago when the Nurses Health Initiative published data that low fat did not change risk of breast cancer. And so when they got to looking at the Nurses Health Initiative, the lowest fat diet of those nurses was 26% of the calories came from fat. Again, that's not considered low fat when you look at around the world. And so, you know, to really see an effect on low fat, you have to get the percentage down to around 10 to 15% of the calories come from fat. And when it gets down to that level, then you start seeing changes in disease risk. But until you drop the percentage down low enough, you're not going to see a cause and effect. And that's what keeps the public confused. And that's the purpose of a lot of these studies. It's either a front group from some meat or big ag group that funds the study. And now that it's becoming where you basically have to report your funding, well, there's all kinds of front groups now that are front groups for other front groups. So it's really difficult to follow the money trail.
I want to read this from... So one of the places that we highly recommend people to get their information is from a website called nutritionfacts.org. And Dr. Michael Greger heads this. It is not funded by any kind of industry. It is just funded by private donation. He researches papers and provides the information from those papers to you, the public, free of charge. I mean, anyone can access his website for free and get this information, and you can choose to donate if you want or not. But the idea is that he reads these articles and he digs through them and he finds out who actually did fund them and if they came up with some kind of crazy, you know, the headline is, you know, butter is back or whatever, then he digs down and finds out, you know, what's going on. But this was the beginning of one of his recent articles. Actually, he does videos, which is great because they're quick 5-minute videos about a topic. And I was on his site this morning looking at, you know, research papers and his thoughts on those. And this particular one, he says, one of the critical questions to ask when reading a medical journal article is who funded the study. In most journals, researchers are required to identify their sources of funding. So what's the problem? Well, researchers can obscure the true origin of financial support. They can hide it, disguise it, or even launder the money through a front group. Case in point, a study downplaying the risks of lung cancer, funded in part by the Foundation for Lung Cancer, which you would think would be the legitimate organization, right? That doesn't sound so bad until you realize it's underwritten by millions from a tobacco company. See, there's no obligation to disclose a funding source's source of funding. And this was what allows companies to evade financial disclosure requirements and makes it harder for us to follow the money trail. I mean, how is the general public supposed to know that?
They're not.
That's the game right there.
That's right.
I just call that the ethical tipping point. You know, it's how much money would you have to pay someone before they will
lie, in essence.
Exactly. Skew the data, deny the presence of God or just anything, you know?
Well, and I guess on one hand, you would say, well, no matter who funded it, if the study shows that...
But the science shows...
But it doesn't.
They're just going to keep doing it until they get the outcome they want.
The science shows that the source of the funding matters.
In the outcome of the study.
In the outcome of the study. So they're 10 times more likely to find in favor of the funding source. 10 times more likely to find in favor of the funding source.
Yeah.
Yes, it says his next statement says, why does the funding source matter? Every single one of 8 reviews covering over 1,000 studies found that research funded by industry is more likely to make conclusions that are favorable to that industry.
And it just, I mean, on one hand, I understand how that occurs. I mean, because... Mm-hmm. You feel obligated
right.
for your funding source,
right.
but that's not real science. I mean, ideally, these companies would donate to a central funding agent.
Yes.
And let them do the...
And let them dole out the money.
Yes.
And then nobody knows, you know, the right hand doesn't know what the left hand's doing. Mm-hmm. And that's the only way to get unbiased information.
Well, the other part that I didn't realize until, you know, years of us doing this and... getting this sort of information was that, so this organization here that I just talked about, this lung cancer organization, and they hire someone to do these studies. Say they did 10 studies and 9 of the studies actually showed detrimental effects on the lung due to lung cancer, but somehow they were able to do one that did not. They are only obligated, not even obligated, they only have to
they
publish.
They don't have to do anything.
They don't have to do anything, but they can publish just that one study.
Yep.
I mean, if all 10 showed negative, then they wouldn't have to disclose any of that.
But now there's every trial has to be registered since like 2004. So we know the number of trials that are being funded. And we know the publication rate. So, and unfortunately, it's like less than 10% of the funded trials are published.
Because they must not be in their favor.
Well, and before that became a requirement that you had to list the trials, we had no idea how many trials were being done. So like a drug company, let's say XYZ drug company, they fund 10 trials. Well, it's got to be reported that those 10 trials were funded. It's like trials.gov. And so you can see the number of trials that were done. And then you know the number of publications that come out of those trials. And
but each trial does not have to, in and of itself, they don't require them to have to publish the results of those trials.
Correct.
Still.
But at least we made some headway, and we know how many trials are being done and the publication rate. But it is minuscule as to the number of trials that are being funded. And so you get a huge biasness. And, you know, the way science works, it's not cut and dried like most people think.
Well, there's especially with... I mean, I think there may be some certain things you can do that are more cut and dry, but I think with food
yes.
and nutrition studies, I think it's really hard to, because what I think we're finding is that a lot of studies are like self-reported.
Correct.
You know, you go out and do a survey of a group of, you get a group of people and you mm-hmm. send them a survey and you are asking them what they eat. Well, I can tell you by, you know, I'm a health coach and working with people, what people tell you they're eating and right. what they're actually eating
yeah.
does not equate.
Mm-hmm.
Correct.
Does not equate.
Only way you can get good data that way is for a food diary.
Right. And hope that they're
honest.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, and that's a part of the problem with some of these studies that, if, you know, there was a study reported a couple of years ago that vegans had poor health. Well, in the country that this they did the study, which was Eastern European country, it was common for people that had health problems to be told by their physician to go on a plant-based diet. So you had all these people that identified as plant-based.
But they were already sick.
But they were already sick. Right. And so, yeah, their health was worse than the general public. And so from superficially looking at that study, you'd say, well, veganism actually causes disease. When you look really at what was going on, well, these people were put on a diet because they were already diseased. It's kind of like me and heart disease.
Well, yeah.
And so... You know, if you look at a general population and they self-report, but they don't report why they're doing it, then you get skewed results as well. And a lot of this stuff that's published is published with the purpose of confusing people. So, you know, I think they've been appropriately labeled by Dr. McDougall as confusionists. It's kind of hard for me
to say. Well, and I think it's in their interest whether or not that study, you know, whether those studies are actually true or not, it benefits them because then people are going to just throw up their arms and say, well, I don't know. This says it's good and I like to eat it. So
correct.
If this one study is saying that, then I'm going to go ahead and...
Yeah, and if you think about any food, whether it's beef, pork, chicken, turkey, fish, cheese... You can find a study that says that that's really nutritious. No, and that it's
well, there was just a study about cheese, but then Dr. Gregory reported on that. The study was funded by the largest dairy funding source in the world, which was this dairy group from China.
Now, yeah.
Of all countries.
Yeah.
Where, why would there need to be a dairy support group in China when most of the Chinese people are lactose intolerant. I mean, it's... ridiculous.
Well, and in the documentary Got the Facts on Milk, Dr. Bernard, I believe, mentions that, you know, in the last 30 years, there's been like 2,000 studies on milk, and only two of them have shown a positive outcome, and both those studies were done by the same person funded by the dairy industry.
Right.
So again, you know.
But...
That still makes headlines.
Yep. And that's but what those people... make headlines, not even though the other studies were done, even if they are published and accessible, you don't see the media reporting on those because that's such a Debbie Downer. Like, nobody wants to hear that cheese is bad.
It doesn't sell.
It doesn't sell. People want to know that cheese is good because, my gosh, I mean, we all love cheese, right?
And nobody's going to watch Dr. Oz if...
He's on there every day telling
talking
you
about
not
how bad
to.
Cheese is and don't eat bacon and don't eat fish and, you know, I mean, yeah.
Yeah, people, they want the license to eat the food that they've always eaten. And so many times we get, you know, people that come to our seminars and bless their heart, they just keep saying, well, what about this? And I read this and what about this? And it's like, you can tell them all day long that.
Right.
That I mean, that was irrelevant. That doesn't make that study was flawed. That's this. That's that. But you know, you hear you know a big thing is with the influx of Alzheimer's.
Right.
You know, people think, well, 10% fat. That's not good for my brain. My brain. You need fat.
Gotta have fat. You gotta have cholesterol
for that
too.
For your brain.
And it's true. You have to have cholesterol to have. Functioning nerves, but your body produces all the cholesterol you need. You don't need to consume...
Eat cholesterol to make your body...
right. You don't need to consume excess cholesterol.
That would make our bodies very inefficient to say, well, you better consume that
right.
cholesterol so that I can actually
you know
make cholesterol.
What's frightening about Alzheimer's is it is the fastest growing disease in the United States. And... what they're finding is that...
Let's hold that thought for 1 second. Let's take a break, a real quick break, and we'll come back and we'll talk about
Alzheimer's.
Listen, gather round. I found something for you. If you listen well, I'm here to tell you you cannot lose. Oh, a simple song, simple melody, yeah. To remind you that you can be the greatest ever, defeated never. Oh, even though sometimes you may lose, oh my. Yes, you can now.
Thank you for sticking with us and coming back. And we've been talking about the crazy studies that get funded and things that we hear and the headline news and all this. And it's led us to one of the things that we do hear quite often is that you do need a higher fat diet and you need to consume things like coconut oil and all these things because your body needs that fat to nourish the brain.
Correct. So the funny thing with coconut oil is it doesn't look to be quite as inflammatory as some of the other saturated fats, although it is the highest saturated fat of most of the oils that we consume. And, you know, when I do the seminar, I always start off with there are no healthy oils. And so people are always asking because of the popularity of the Mediterranean diet and the fact that they consumed olive oil in the Mediterranean diet and this fact that coconut oil has been propagated as being a healthy fat alternative. And so, you know, I go through this and I say it, I can't tell you how many times during the presentation, I'd say, you know, there are no healthy oils.
Right.
And invariably, at the end of the presentation, I get asked, well, what about olive oil? What about coconut oil? When right. I've gone through it 100 times.
Well, right. And don't you need that for brain health?
I know. And it's just this message that people have absorbed due to, again, inaccurate information. There are no healthy oils, period. And so, you know, when we say something like that, what we're doing is we're always comparing it to something.
Mm-hmm.
So if you compared olive oil to canola oil, yeah, it's a little healthier than canola oil. But it's not healthy in and of itself
right.
because it is a highly processed, nutrient poor, extremely high caloric food-like substance that doesn't exist in nature.
And the better of bad is not good.
Well, correct. And I think, you know, and you know this, but when people look at the Mediterranean diet, it's like we don't want to look at the whole picture that really is what a true Mediterranean diet is.
We
want to
pick
pull
and
the things that we like. And it's like of everything that the people that ate that diet did, we somehow just came back with they ate olive oil, so that's good. I mean, that was
right?
the end of it. Not the fact that they ate the super healthy green.
Mm-hmm.
Correct.
That was a very cholesterol-fighting green. That was a big part of their diet. And I can also guarantee you the amounts of olive oil they used were not near what we consume in the United States. I mean, the problem in the United States is if we feel like something is good, I mean, like coconut oil. If we heard coconut oil is good, by gosh, we're throwing it in our coffee. We're
right.
eating spoonfuls of it. It's not that maybe if you got a little bit of coconut oil in something that might be, you know, okay. But we take everything to such extremes and eat it in such mass quantities.
Well, we were eating the Mediterranean diet. At least we thought.
We had deceived
again, ourselves into...
We were eating lots of olive oil.
and lamb, you know, because
yeah.
when
yeah.
I read the book about the Mediterranean diet and they had lamb, well... Yeah, okay. Well, they had lamb, so I'm eating lots of lamb.
Right. That's right.
And, you know, my triglycerides were over 3,200.
But you read that book, and that was your takeaway.
Right.
You never mentioned the greens.
Oh, I know.
That was
the
sideshow.
Well, who wants to eat goat weed? That's what we call that green here in the United States. It's purslane, and it has a chemical in it that reverses cholesterol, lowers cholesterol better than any statin. And they ate bunches of it at lunch and bunches of it at supper.
The other thing is they were an active culture, too.
Oh, they're right.
extremely
right.
active. And the things that they did, and even the amount of lamb or fish or whatever, that wasn't, you know, we make that, you know, the main portion of our meal here. And then we put maybe a little piece of a broccoli beside it. Or, you know, something to, you know, that extent. But there, everything, the greens and all the other fresh things that they served were the main portion of their meal. And the fish or the lamb or whatever just was a side.
It was a flavoring.
A side condiment type of thing. It wasn't like a huge rack like we see, you know, served up here in America. We are The country of abundance.
Well, we mentioned briefly about the rise in Alzheimer's and how prevalent it is now. And I had posted something from the Blue Zones yesterday about the benefit of sleep and the effects of sleep deprivation. And this was remarkable to me. It says, according to the sleep neuroscientist Matthew Walker at the University of California, Berkeley, the number of people who can survive on 6 hours of sleep or less without measurable impairment, rounded to a whole number and expressed as a percent, is zero. Okay? Is zero. Okay? So they talk about the spikes in deaths, in cancer, in heart attacks, and suicides rises dramatically after daylight savings time when people lose that hour. And they said that volunteers who were kept awake for 31 hours straight showed huge spikes in the Alzheimer's-causing molecule compared with well-rested participants.
Right.
Hardly pulling an all-nighter is harmless.
Well, yes. And that...
You know, when I had to get board certified with lifestyle medicine, one of the things I had to study was sleep hygiene, which was a concept I was really not aware of.
Right.
Even... I mean, I'm talking like this was 6 months ago, and I wasn't aware of all the detrimental things we do that prevents good sleep hygiene. And, you know, one of them is
turning your phone off,
that we are locked into, and television and the blue light that comes from that. And
so
how
the blue light that comes from television or phone or any kind of screen, the way I understand it, it blocks the melatonin from your body from producing the melatonin you need to be sleepy and to go to sleep and have a good sleep.
So it's like our brains were programmed to have bright sunshine during the day.
Right.
And about 5 o'clock to get out of the sunlight and not be in front of any blue light source. Firelight doesn't have a very big blue light footprint. So it was more like we were meant to be inside by a fire, and then that helped produce our sleepiness to where, you know, at 8:30, 9 o'clock, we're ready to go to bed. So we go to bed when the sun goes down, and we rise when the sun comes up, and that's the way we were best meant to function. And so sleep deprivation now is called the new smoking or the new tobacco. Because it has that kind of detrimental effect on your health.
Well, I think the more now that we're so consumed with our screens, it's really wreaking havoc with our sleep patterns.
I must admit, I've faced this problem for a while. You know, first you think, why do we wake up in the middle of the night and wonder what time it is?
Mm-hmm.
But so I was guilty of this. I would wake up, I'd wonder what time it was, I'd reach over and pick up my phone, and it would show me what time it was. And then I would be like, oh, I got a message. Or, oh, I got... And so then, you know, next thing you know, I'm like...
You're down the rabbit hole.
I'm down the rabbit hole 30 minutes later and, you know,
oh,
I'm awake.
No.
All the time. Every night I would do that. Then I get a little speaker thing with Alexa. So now what I do is I wake up and I say, hey, Alexa, blink. What time is it? It's 2:25 a.m. And then I just... Go back to sleep. So I don't get interrupted with the blue light or anything like that, which...
I actually have an alarm clock, Randy, that sits on my nightstand that actually tells me the time.
Yeah, I'm way past that.
You've moved past the...
Radio Shack is closed.
Well, at least it's not a wind-up clock.
Yeah, Radio Shack's closed, so I'm done with those. So,
anyway. You know, Alexa's listening to you all the time.
That's okay. I cuss a lot, so... Yeah, that's okay.
Yeah, sleep is something that I think people, you know, it's almost like a proudness. Oh, I don't need any sleep.
It's like how many beers you can have.
Yeah, I can get by on 4 or 5 hours sleep. It's,
not me.
You know, overrated.
I'm an 8 hour guy.
Oh, I'm an 8 to 10 hour.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I have been this way my whole life.
I have too. I never could stay up late, even in college. One time I stayed up all night long. And it was totally by accident.
It's easier when you're in your 20s, obviously.
Yeah.
But now I, and high school, college, I mean, 10 o'clock, I was out.
Now, internship and things were, I mean...
Well, that's different because you actually do learn how... I mean, so as a first in, or as a what is referred to as the first year ortho resident, which is your second year of training.
Postgraduate, right.
So second and third year where I trained, we averaged 120 hours a week in the hospital.
That's over.
It was insane. And once I went 5 days.
That's over 10. That's what, 15 hours and 20 hours a day?
That one time I went 5 days without sleep. And at the end of the fifth day, about midnight, I started hallucinating. My feet were so swollen I couldn't hardly stand on them. And I had, you know, I still had to function from midnight to 6 o'clock before my shift ended. And that was the worst that I can remember. But what happened, though, was I would get used to having to be up. Right. And so when I started practice, about every third night, I would stay up all night. Just I was wide awake because my brain had been trained that way. And I could actually function sleep deprived. Now, I can't do that now because, you know, I've lost that training, thank goodness. And now if I'm up past midnight, I don't function very well at all the next day.
Right.
And maybe some of that's just being 63 years of age. I don't know. But I can't function sleep deprived.
This says residents working a 30-hour shift are 460% more likely to make diagnostic errors in the intensive care unit relative to when they're working 16 hours. I mean, that's just unbelievable, you know? And it from the outside in, it just seems like our medical system, how we train physicians, has always been that this is the way we do it. We keep everybody up.
Oh, you know, yeah, and it's kind of a status symbol a little bit to say, I worked.
I worked all night. Mm-hmm. I was in the ICU all night. I'm thinking.
I would rather, as a patient, have someone that had some sleep and was fresh than to have someone that I knew had been
on as a resident, it was not unusual at all to be, because, you know, we'd stay up all night and then we'd have to go either in surgery, and surgery wasn't a problem because you're actively engaged, but when we'd go to the clinic after being up all night, it was not uncommon to fall asleep talking to patients.
Oh my goodness.
And, you know, you'd kind of startle yourself awake and go, okay, where were we? But, I mean, all the time because it was horrible. But I don't want to justify it, but there was benefit from it because you learn how to function in that state, even though you are more prone to making mistakes. You know, first time I took call at a big hospital here in Oklahoma City when I first started practice, I mean, it was like being a resident. I had close to 20 admissions on a weekend.
Oh, my.
And so I was...
These people need to be more careful.
I was working all weekend long.
Yeah.
And then, you know, in practice, you don't have that day off after that.
Well, we've digressed. We like to go down rabbit holes.
That's right.
Squirrels, I don't know. We chase them all the time. One last thing, though, that I thought was interesting from nutritionfacts.org when it came to research and getting access to that was the cost of a journal.
Is outrageous.
You think that a doctor is going to automatically, I don't know why we think this, but we think that some physician, your primary care doctor, your cardiologist, whoever, is going to automatically be updated on the latest and greatest research out there on whatever it is he or she is practicing or doing. But I don't think everybody knows, like, the cost of the journals that you have that you would have to have to get this information is ridiculous.
It is ridiculous, and it's getting worse. So I subscribe to the Journal of Shoulder and Elbow Surgery. And that's almost $500 a year, just that one subscription to that journal.
Wow.
And then the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery, that's $200 a year.
Journal of Hand and Finger.
I mean, so you got all these journals that you really need it, the information from. And what's crazy is like the Journal of Shoulder and Elbow Surgery. Most of that research is supported by public funds.
Well, and that's what he goes on to say in this article, is that the taxpayers are paying for this research to be done.
Correct.
And these places do the research.
For National Institute of Health.
And then it goes, and then how does it go from being done to into these journals that get sold for these outrageous prices?
It's because they're for-profit companies that publish these journals. And they're prestigious journals, some of the most prestigious journals in the world. Now, recently, meaning in the last few years, there's been a trend towards what's called open access. So if research is supported by public funds, then it is open, meaning it may be on like the Journal of Shoulder and Elbow Surgery, but they will have an open access article. And so the public can get access to that. But the problem is not all of them are open access. Mm-hmm. And so unless it's open access, then you have to pay for it. And so if you buy, like, say I see an article written in Clinical Orthopedics and Related Research, which is another orthopedic journal, and I want to get a copy of that article, it could cost $100 just for that one article.
Wow.
That's just crazy.
And so there was a lady who basically broke the system. And she's been named as one of the most influential people in the world. And I'm not sure how she broke the firewalls for all the pay sources, but she has a website where you can get access to just about anything that's ever been published.
Well, I guess what I didn't even... You know, you think so much about just America, but what he was saying is here's like rural countries and poor countries and physicians that are in these other countries, they can't afford to get these journals and access to this kind of stuff. And
right.
So it was very important to have the ability to access it for free so that everybody can have access to this information.
Yeah, and Dr. Greger actually mentions her website.
Sci-Hub, I think.
SCI-HUB.TW.
That's odd.
Mm-hmm. I don't know what that is.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, she was from one of the Eastern European countries, Kazakhstan.
Oh, okay.
And so Sci-Hub, I mean, I get articles from Sci-Hub, but I didn't know about the .TW. Because I actually pay for access to Sci-Hub.
Well, now you know.
So, I mean, the stuff's not inexpensive either.
No.
And so, especially with the nutrition research, it's hard to get access to a lot of those. But thankfully, the American Society for Nutrition, their journal is now open access.
Well, if nothing else, I hope that we've opened everyone's minds a little bit to what when you see these articles and these sensational headlines, that you need to take a step back and say, wait just a minute, that doesn't really make a lot of sense.
It sounds too good to be true. It's too good to be
yes.
true.
And really, you know, put on your critical thinking hat and really try not to believe every single headline like that comes along.
So, you know, with as little bias as I can acknowledge, the healthiest way for humans to eat is whole plant food.
Well, and what I was going to say to that point is, yes, there is research that shows that, and there's not a lot of funding going into plants, I have
right.
to tell everyone. So there's really not a lot of bias that can go into that industry. I mean, there's some to dispute it, but
there's not big broccoli.
Yeah, there's not, you know.
Super spinach.
But I think what's important to look at just from a generality is look at populations like the blue zones where there are the highest concentration of centenarians, people that live over 100,
yep.
concentrated in these blue zones where they eat mostly plants. I mean, yes, they might use a little bit of olive oil, or they might have a little bit of meat occasionally, but these are very small amounts. They're used as maybe some flavorings. They get most of their calories from plants. They're extremely active people. I'm sure they probably get their 8 hours of sleep.
Because, absolutely.
You know, that's how these cultures are. And those are the people that should show us that that's the healthiest way to live. I mean, just by
example. Right. And, you know, one of the blue zones I think is really fascinating. That's Okinawa, because the traditional Okinawan diet, over 80% of their calories came from yams. And yeah, they had a little bit of seafood, but I mean, it was minuscule. Mm-hmm. And then
they had to catch what they ate, and then mostly. There may be some markets they could go, but
in a blue moon, they would have pork as a festive occasion.
Right.
But that didn't make up much of their overall calories. So you're talking like maybe once a year for some big celebration, they'd kill a hog and eat parts of that.
Mm-hmm.
But that wasn't something they did every day. And then in 1945, at the cessation of hostilities, the United States sets up a base there in Okinawa. And now Okinawa has the highest per capita concentration of fast food restaurants in the entire world. And so the traditional Okinawans that ate primarily yams, they're thriving over 100. But the younger generation that, you know, are in their 50s and 60s, they're dying right and left of heart attacks because they've been eating this fast food and they strayed from their traditional diet. And so there's no question what's
But even in healthy. Our own culture, maybe they didn't live to be over 100, but just looking back at our own grandparents here and the way they, you know, like you would say, like your grandma cooked a chicken, well, it fed a family of 10.
Right.
And that chicken was not a hormone-injected chicken. It was, the chickens back then were a lot smaller than they are now.
And they ran around scratching on the ground.
Yes. And she goes and cooks that chicken to feed everybody. And then everything else, with potatoes and vegetables and all those other things that went into that meal. I mean,
in 1900, 80% of our calories came from plants here in the United States. And in 2015, 12% of our calories come from plants, but half of that are potato chips and french fries.
Right.
Oh, so, we just got to get back to the basics. And
hey, that sounds like love. A country and western
of
song.
Love.
Yes.
We do.
Hey, why don't you belt that out here in our last minute of the show?
I can if y'all would like, but I'm going to have to take a special request on the radio to do it.
Well, I hope we've given you all some food for thought, and if you're interested in coming...
No pun intended.
Yes, exactly. If you're interested in coming to any of our seminars, please go to our website, plantbasedokc.com, and come to some of our events that we list on there. We would love to have you.
Not too late to come tonight.
No. Well, by the time they hear this, it will be.
Oh, that's right. That's right. It will be.
So we're actually taping this on a Monday since Randy gave this away.
That's okay.
Yeah. So anyway, just check our website. We'll be at Rococo the first Monday of most months.
That's
but
right.
If you check our website, you'll know for sure. We'll have our monthly seminars available. So please check for that information. We'd love to have you. And go to nutritionfacts.org for any of your questions regarding the latest headline sensational news. I'm sure Michael Greger will have something about that.
The other good resource to counteract the sensational headlines is John McDougall. I mean, if something is sensationalized, he'll usually have a commentary. And it's really well thought out and fact-based.
So Dr. John McDougall is a plant-based physician we follow, and he's got a great website. So there's a lot of those plant-based physicians that we do follow and get some information. And so we would recommend.
What do you mean? I am
well.
A plant-based.
Well, as well as you. Yes.
That's right. All right.
Okay,
the train's leaving.
We're wrapping it up. And so we want to just wish you all a great new year, and we encourage you to live life on purpose and with purpose.
Amen.
Thank you.